Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Trump administration could be looking to narrow immunity for tech companies when they remove what they consider objectionable content from their platforms. CNN technology reporter Brian Fung has been covering the issue. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
So what we know about is a draft order from the White House. It addresses Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act. What does that section do?
Well, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act essentially gives broad blanket immunity to online platforms such as Facebook and Twitter, allowing them to moderate the content that appears on their platform so they can take down content if they believe it's objectionable without facing the threat of lawsuits from the public or from the government as a result of having done that.
And what were the thoughts behind Section 230 at the time in 1996? Why was this seen as something to address?
Well, according to the lawmakers who drafted the bill that later became part of the legislation, they have said that they wanted to preserve essentially the freedom of speech on the internet because that it is vital to the growth of internet startups to be able to manage their platforms in ways free from government or other control.
Obviously, Facebook's not a startup. Pinterest, Twitter, they're giants now, and some people think they're just too big. But federal regulations controlling them have not been put forth in the past, at least not in any successful way. What does this draft portend?
Well, the draft, and it's important to point out that this is still just a work in progress.
Right.
That could change significantly. What we received last week was a snapshot, a summary, if you will, of what this draft looks like right now. And under the current proposal, the White House would theoretically ask the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission for essentially, new approaches and new interpretations of Section 230 that could make it harder for tech companies to moderate their platforms, as they wish. One of the things that the draft order sort of considers or contemplates is asking the Federal Communications Commission for new regulations that would then sort of lay out when the tech companies are able to receive immunity from lawsuits.
What does the Federal Trade Commission have to do with all of this?
So the Federal Trade Commission is empowered to go after companies when those companies have violated antitrust laws or have engaged in allegedly unfair or deceptive conduct. So, companies like Equifax, for instance, were penalized by the Federal Trade Commission. One of the things that the FTC said was Equifax violated people's privacy, and there's a whole body of law and FTC guidance that sort of lays out you have to be transparent with consumers about how you use people's data and what you must do if you lose control of that data and the sort of thinking behind the Equifax settlement was, the company failed to uphold its promises to consumers.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the contents of, or at least a snapshot of the contents of, a draft order out of the White House that might or could narrow immunity for tech companies when they remove or what they consider objectionable content from their platforms. My guest is CNN technology reporter Brian Fung, who's been covering the issue. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You interviewed Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. He wrote Section 230. He's not happy about the proposed change. What are his objections?
Well, the big objection here is that there are a number of First Amendment concerns potentially that he raises. When you bring up the prospect of the FCC developing regulations saying when companies like Facebook could be exposed to lawsuits over the way that it moderates the content on its platform, particularly as it regards, you know, political speech. That, to a lot of legal experts and to Senator Wyden, who was one of the co-authors of Section 230, very much appears like an effort to create what he called a speech police. And that could be very troubling to, you know, a lot of onlookers who are sort of working on this issue, and could potentially be a roadblock for you know, the White House as it's trying to put together you know, an executive order that will have to survive legal scrutiny.
Okay, and what is the significance of making it an executive order versus a law change?
Well, you know, there's as we've sort of seen, there's very little right now that can pass Congress. You know, Congress is extremely divided, and you know, the likelihood of significant legislation affecting the tech industry, you know, well, most issues, but particularly affecting the tech industry, seem very, very low right now. And so, one of the ways that the White House, not just this White House, but the previous White House under President Obama, have tried to get around some of this congressional deadlock is by using, you know, executive orders to an increasing degree. And, you know, for the Trump administration, this would sort of be a similar way of trying to develop policy regulating the tech industry without resorting to legislation. Now, it's important to point out here that in addition to the First Amendment concerns facing this draft executive order, there are also a number of administrative law concerns and questions about whether or not the executive order or the White House would even have the ability to ask the FCC and FTC to undertake oversight of and responsibility for a law that doesn't really address either agency.
Has this been an issue? Okay, you kind of answered my question, but I was going to ask if this has been an issue that the FCC and the FTC have talked about in terms of wanting to get involved in it.
Well, interestingly, I spoke to one lawyer who brought up the fact that the FCC did at one point try to invoke Section 230 as a way to justify an early version of its net neutrality rules. Now, you might remember that net neutrality is the principle that internet providers shouldn't block websites or slow them down or prevent, you know, consumers from being able to access the websites that they want to. And, you know, the FCC at the time, in about 2010, said, you know, we think that we, you know, when we're trying to develop regulations for the cable industry or the internet providers, that Section 230 gives us some power to do that. And, you know, when this got brought before the courts, and the courts said, no, actually, FCC, you can't invoke Section 230 here because you didn't actually draw the appropriate legal connection to why, you know, you feel the need to use this law. So it has been addressed before, but not, you know, in a really comprehensive sense, and not in the sense that would really give the FCC jurisdiction over social media platforms, which is really what this executive order is all about.
Right. In the draft, the White House pointed to anecdotal evidence of bias on the part of social media companies. That's what this is all about. What was the alleged bias, and where did the evidence come from? Do you know?
So this is become sort of a familiar talking point among conservative activists who said, you know, when they engage with social media, whether that be Facebook or Twitter, they often experience what they believe to be discrimination by the tech platforms themselves, perhaps being, you know, unable to find, you know, other Twitter users that share similar ideologies as they do, or, you know, having content taken down in ways that they believe is politically motivated. It's important to point out here that there's no systematic evidence that any researcher or analyst has been able to produce, you know, regarding these allegations about anti-conservative bias. Nevertheless, the president has been very vocal about these allegations and has vowed to sort of find and use any and all measures that he can to try and combat what he says is a form of unfair discrimination against conservatives.
So in this draft, they point to anecdotal evidence, but they don't provide sources for the anecdotes.
Well, they the White House actually set up a website to solicit concerns from consumers about anti-conservative bias. And according to the summary that CNN saw, the White House says it has collected something like 15,000 anecdotal complaints, and that, you know, as part of this draft executive order, the White House would be forwarding many of those complaints to the Federal Trade Commission for, its enforcement purposes. So as part of this moves forward, I think one question will be just what the White House's involvement is in collecting and disseminating sort of this this talking point about anti-conservative bias.
Right. Are the complaints public record?
Well, the website is available to the public, and the presumably the docket that the FTC is would be asked to set up would also be public. Presumably allowing, consumers to take a look at what's been filed there.
Any sense about how this draft proposal might play out in the case of, say, the El Paso mass murderer who posted a manifesto on 8chan,
well, I should say? That's a really interesting question because, at the same time that the White House is drafting this executive order, last week the White House invited a number of tech companies in for a meeting to talk about whether or not they were doing enough to censor, online violent extremism. And, for a lot of onlookers here, the question becomes, well, where do you draw the line between content that the tech companies should be taking down and content that the White House believes to be conservative content that should be kept up, and where does the government draw its authority in being able to say block this content but not that content?
How have the FTC and the FCC responded to all of this?
Well, neither agency is commenting officially, but a lot of the commissioners at both agencies have gone on the record previously, sort of expressing strong support for the First Amendment, and from folks around Washington, D.C., who I've spoken to, sort of get the sense that, many of the commissioners at both agencies would have strong reservations potentially about being asked to carry out this executive order.
And what about the tech giants? What are they saying?
They're also relatively quiet on this specific issue. I think the particularly given that the executive order is still in a draft stage and there isn't an official text that's been seen by anyone yet, at least publicly, I think that both in the early stages of this process, and because the tech industry is facing so much other scrutiny in addition to these allegations about anti-conservative bias, the industry is being very reticent to sort of weigh in on this publicly.
Laying low. So, as we've mentioned repeatedly, it is a draft proposal. I don't know if it was leaked or whatever out of the White House. What's the trajectory from this point? What do you expect, or what kind of speed with which it will be addressed?
Well, if this is past this prologue, I think this executive order will continue to be developed over the coming weeks and months, and a lot of how it moves forward will depend on some of the public feedback or the public reaction to the reporting surrounding what's in the draft. And you might remember a few months ago there was a big debate about whether or not a White House proposal for a nationalized 5G wireless network. And that idea was very quickly shot down by members of the FCC, other sort of legal experts and telecom experts. And so then, the White House was sort of forced to back down on that. I imagine that, depending on the nature of the feedback here in the wake of this leaked draft summary, that we may see something similar play out.
Do you wonder if that's what they're doing anyway, is leaking it to just take the temperature? Not unheard of.
That's certainly not unheard of. I can't speculate as to the motivations for, who or why this draft was leaked. But I do think that gaining as much visibility into this draft as possible is certainly going to give the public more opportunity to weigh in on whether or not this is a good idea.
Brian Fung, thanks for helping us do that today. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
It's Brian Fung. He's a technology reporter for CNN. We've been talking about a draft proposal out of the White House that would narrow immunity for tech companies when they monkey with content on their platforms. More Tech Tuesdays coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Next week's the first day of school for Columbus City Schools. Other districts are going back this week. Back to school means back to routines and back to daily learning for children. And technology can come in handy for staying on track and making sure kids retain what they've learned. Warren Buckleitner is editor of Children's Technology Review and an assistant professor at the College of New Jersey. Welcome back, Warren.
It's good to be with you, Ann.
Before a child even sets foot in a school, what kind of help can they get from a device?
Well, lots of help. And increasingly, it's kids who have access to devices and internet that have an advantage over other kids. So it's important to make sure your child has everything they need to complete assignments and stay in touch with their classmates.
And, staying in touch with their classmates, what does that involve?
Texting. I watch with my own kids who are now in their early 20s sort of how they use technology to coordinate things like help with homework and studying and using shared kinds of services, shared Google Docs to get an assignment done. And it's really in a way kind of heartbreaking to see when you're a teacher and you have kids that don't have that access, because the children who have access and can, you know, quickly do the stuff you and I take for granted, like a search or pull up an image or throw together a video, they can do work that is above and beyond those who don't have that access. So it's really important as we get into back to school to make sure the kids aren't handicapped.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with Warren Buckleitner, editor for Children's Technology Review, about how to use tech to help kids ease into the new school year. If you have a question or comment for Warren, if you're looking at an app and you're wondering if it might be worth it, Warren would be glad to tell you what he thinks. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You say that parents should freshen up bookmarks. What do you mean by that and why?
The first thing to do, whether your child's going to college or elementary school, is to call your school or check with a teacher to say, hey, what kind of website should I be tuned into? Every school's got a website. Every high school, middle school has an absentee reporting form. And you don't want to wait until your child is sick before you have to search around and find it. So go in and look at your browser. Make sure your child's aware of, which browser they're using. And then look at your bookmarks, because you can get one-click access to all the important forms. Lots of teachers have their own web page. Bookmark it and make it easy to get to the school resources that they're likely to need.
What are your thoughts about, I think when my kid was in school, was sort of you know, in the new age, you know, when he first started school, you were still getting the packets of paper material at the end of the week,
yeah,
kind of a thing. And then as by the time he was in, I think, junior high or high school, for sure, everything was online. He didn't have to worry about all the paper. But what do you think about how that's worked out?
Well, it amazes me that kids still carry backpacks that are so huge.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like that's their physical education these days. And backpacks don't seem to be shrinking. And we know they're not full of handouts and stuff. But increasingly, that backpack needs to have a digital device. And, it needs to work. And I think that's that's the horse that just about every child needs, either a good late model Chromebook or, you know, whether it's school issued or whatever. They need to make sure they're able to use that.
You say parents should check with teachers about what kind of hardware to get for the kids, right?
Yeah, I mean, the program I teach in at the College of New Jersey, we have pretty specific things that we like when kids walk in the room, and because it's heavily graphic and coding and stuff, we like to have, you know, make sure they have a computer that's not completely fallen apart. And so a lot of parents, you know, before you go out and buy something new, it's smart to ask people who are in the field, you know, what they'd recommend. And, you know, I really do like I think one of the nice things that's happened is the Chromebooks have just dropped in price and increased in power nicely,
mm-hmm,
with good batteries and so on. And if your school is using Google Docs, I don't know what your schools are using, but many schools are, and, you know, they're Google schools in a sense. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but, you know, Google Docs are, in Google Slides and so on, are just so useful. And they bring the cloud to your child, and so it can put them in direct contact with a teacher. I also really like Google Calendar for, you know, so program it this week and put all of your child's classes and homework reminders and school holidays and all those dates that you forget, put them in as events, and then make sure there's a 1 hour reminder or a day reminder, so you kind of know what's coming up, and that'll sort of automate the year and let everybody know what's coming.
You recommend Procreate for kids. What is it and why?
Well, Procreate is a Mac. It's a iPad Pro specific app. So there's a lot of equivalents, but I use it all the time, and I've handed it to many kids. And it's a drawing program because it uses the Apple Pencil or a stylus. And again, you can get similar things on a Chromebook with a touchscreen that work just as good with much cheaper stylus. But if you want to make a sketch or a stop motion for a project, it makes it so easy to make a quick JPEG or a GIF or something that you can add to a presentation. And again, you know what, getting back to that original idea that you want your child to have the largest possible advantage, you know, the world is the world's competitive. And as a teacher, you look at a lot of work, and one of the things that can really make a project sparkle is if there's an original illustration. So that's why I like Procreate. It's either $5 or $10 app. And again, you do need to have an iPad Pro with a stylus.
How much of class assignment is about presentations and using your hardware to create presentations like that?
Well, for my own kids, you know, going through high school, it was a lot. And what happened was, at TCNJ, it's huge. The kids present a lot, but I think different programs have different requirements. But increasingly, it is important to be able to stand in front of a group and put an idea together and then illustrate those ideas with catchy content that looks good and is clear and edited. And that's, you know, I think it's a new literacy. And I think that, you know, it's time, if we haven't yet, literacy means being fluent in a language that today in any workplace is going to involve working with cloud-based information and heavy graphics and so on. So, again, you know, it gets back to give your child the tools that are powerful and easy to use so that they're likely to succeed.
What do you recommend for younger kids?
Well, here's a dramatic idea. go get an analog clock, you know, the ones with the hands.
Yeah.
This is crazy, but it worked. And so what you do is you put the clock within range of where they have their cereal or oatmeal in the morning and waiting for the bus. And as that big hand moves around, you put a sticker on it for when it's time to run out to the bus. And that, I haven't really seen a good digital device. You know, you can do Google reminders and so on, but mm-hmm. an analog device lets you see that, oh, it's approaching, you know, it's coming around and it's time to go. And that works like a charm. And that gets back to another really old-fashioned idea, and that is to keep a regular routine. Now is a good time to sort of set up your home environment for a place to hang the backpack, place to charge the devices. And, you know, when you get home, when the child gets home, let's just sit down and get the homework done and get that routine in place. And that makes life so much easier.
What about rules as far as using devices? They're using them in school now, so you know they're getting screen time there.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm a former school teacher. I'm also a developmental psychologist, my daughter reminds me. And what that means is that I'll use every trick in the book to get kids to do stuff, whether I'm in front of a classroom or their own, my own kids or whatever. So, and so you can use rewards. So like every kid loves Fortnite, and a good half hour to an hour playing with a kid with Fortnite is a blast. It really blows off steam and so on, but that's a great reward for getting homework done. And so use the digital content or just watching a movie together is such a good thing. You know, use that as a reward, but, you know, keeping that routine, I was working with a very smart teacher once that, who said the secret weapon to good behavior is a predictable routine. And so if you can get that set up and kind of stick to it, it does make everything from coming home from school, getting homework done, and then bedtime, all that kind of things go smoother.
For kids 7 and up, you recommend Harry Potter, Wizards Unite. Why is that? What works for that for you?
Well, I don't know if I recommend it yet because it's new. I just thought it'd be fun for us to talk about
it.
Yeah, because it's, you know, we all know about Pokemon Go, mm-hmm. the geolocation kind of game. And so at SIGGRAPH out in San Francisco 2 weeks ago, they announced, J.K. Rowling and Warner Brothers announced this new virtual world. And I've also heard that one's coming for Minecraft. Mm-hmm. And so we grown-ups need to kind of keep our eye on this stuff so that we're smarter than a fifth grader.
I've given up, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, we can pretend.
Yeah.
But this one's really, you know, it's cool because there's more social things. So you'll see clusters of kids going around collecting different spells and trying not to be a muggle and, you know, using their devices to walk around in J.K. Rowling's imagination. And so I think that's pretty cool. And it's the website is HarryPotterWizardUnite.com. and you can kind of keep up with what's going on. Now, the reason I'm excited is it's created by Niantic. Now, that's the same company that did Pokemon Go. So they really know how to do this genre. And, you know, you mix that with Harry Potter characters, and it's going to be pretty interesting.
You also recommend an older app called Fox Factory. What does that do?
Fox Factory is one of many sort of programming puzzle apps. It's a $3 app. I like to highlight these apps because there's no gimmicks. I've been running every app we review these days and pass through this rubric called the Fred Rogers rubric.
Okay.
And it's basically, would Fred Rogers like this? It's a real simple kind of question, but this is one that passes that test. And in that, what that means is there's no in-app purchases, no manipulation, no data collection. It works offline. And it's just a series of puzzles that are really solid, well-designed. And so you'll get your money's worth out of the $3. And so I was happy to find that one.
What does it do? What kind of games?
Well, there's always a challenge, and you have to get a fox or a maze to build. You reconstruct a world. So there's a fairly effective narrative element to it. But to do that, you take shapes, and you move shapes through an assembly line mm-hmm. that you program. So you drag and drop the parts into place, and the assembly line will cut, color, and turn to rebuild a village. So it's good, and it's leveled well, and so it's just another solid app that's good to have on your child's device, and does run on both Android and Apple devices.
And always you're looking for a learning curve on any of these kinds of things, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, the challenge has to be there, and you want that success, but you also want the challenge, and this does a good job. It's from a studio. And I'm trying to think it's not from Ohio, I guarantee. it's from, I think, Czechoslovakia or somewhere, huh. Studio Pango.
Huh.
And they've been doing some really good work. And these guys have not gotten the memo that it's impossible to make money in the app stores. And they keep making quality apps. So there's no real language behind it. It's just good. There's 70 puzzles, and happy to find stuff like this.
You said they haven't gotten the memo that it's impossible to make money in the app stores. What do you mean? I mean, people keep doing it. There's a gazillion apps out there now.
Yeah. Well, the problem is there's a gazillion apps out mm-hmm. there, and you don't know. Many of them are free and just time sinks. And so that's why you have to be active and or proactive. You have to go find and get and be willing to invest a few bucks to get the products that really are, the motive behind them is to entertain or educate and not to sell something. And so there's, you know, I think that what's happened is many of the good app publishers have gone out of business because there's just no revenue for them. Mm-hmm. And they've either stopped making apps or updating their apps, or they've, gone free, and that means a free trial that you get hit by a paywall at some point. And mm-hmm. so that's not a bad thing either, but it's like you have to remember to, you know, you're vulnerable when you download something that you really don't know how much you're going to spend in the end. And by the way, that's what the Harry Potter Wizards Unite is. It's, quote, free. And just like Pokemon Go, it's always free to start. And how much money will it cost by the time you're done with it? And so I think personally that the world would be a better place if app stores did a better job telling us consumers how much stuff really costs.
Warren Buchleitner, thanks for joining us. Have a great school year.
Thanks, Ann. Same to you.
That's Warren Buchleitner. He's editor for Children's Technology Review. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The forthcoming Samsung Galaxy Note 10 will ditch the headphone jack, but the phone isn't much different otherwise than what the company released a few months ago. With us is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley to talk about it. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
It's releasing a new phone, the Galaxy Note 10 and 10 Plus. It's new, but there's not a lot new about it, right?
Yes. I mean, if you're a fan of the Samsung Galaxy S10, you'll notice that there are a lot of similarities here. The screens are pretty close to the same size. The Note has a slightly larger battery. The cameras have the same processors in them. There's a lot of similarities here. As with anything that has the Galaxy Note branding, you have the pen that, tucks away inside of the casing for the phone, so you can pull the stylus out and take notes and use some of the really cool features that come with that. There are some new features there, including the ability to kind of sketch doodles in midair while having the camera open and have it float in kind of an augmented reality sense, which is super, super handy when you want to draw potentially not nice things above your boss's head in the middle of a meeting. But not super useful for much other than just kind of silliness. The whole thing here really comes down to, Samsung has a familiarity, and it's trying to make sure that everything kind of feels very similar, so that you can move from one phone to the other and feel like you want more. You would kind of upgrade, and so to offer that upgrade, it actually has a different phone, which it calls the Note 10 Plus. The Note 10 Plus is significantly larger than the Note 10. It has an extra camera on the back, bringing the grand total to four on the back of the phone, and has really just a significantly larger battery to go with it.
What's the deal with getting rid of the headphone jack? Is this just what's going to happen in the future?
Yeah, this is the direction that the industry has been heading for a little while. Samsung not only made fun of Apple when it got rid of the headphone jack, but made it a big, kind of marketing selling point for a couple of years that it was keeping the headphone jack. And then weirdly, as soon as it announced that it was removing the headphone jack, all of those ads making fun of Apple disappeared from Samsung's YouTube channel. It was super weird. So there's, it doesn't have a headphone jack anymore. It uses USB Type-C, just like just about everything else that isn't made by Apple right now. And with that comes, the ability to plug in an adapter if you want to use a traditional headphone jack. But the general thought there is that most people are going to be using wireless headphones.
Yes, that is the thing of the future. I have more and more people walking around with white things sticking out of their ears. They move the power button. Why?
Well, there's not an official reason for why they moved the power button, but the big kind of rumor that goes around this phone is that the original design for the Note 10, there was a whole lot of speculation that the Note 10 was actually going to be Samsung's first phone that had no buttons on it whatsoever, no physical buttons for volume or for power or anything like that. It was going to be just a smooth thing all the way around. There was a lot of rumors when the Note was first, kind of being talked about that was what it's going to look like. If I had to guess, I would say that someone at Samsung very high up decided that that was a really bad idea and told them to put the buttons back. And so they had to very quickly put the buttons back on the phone. And that's why everything is all the buttons are on one side of the phone now instead of split across them like you would normally see.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny how, that could be the reason that someone high up just said, yeah, no, we're not going to do that. We are attached to our buttons.
Physical buttons are a big thing. The buttons on the front of the phone for Android phones for a long time there. There's a lot that goes on for being able to press those buttons. And when those went away in exchange for virtual buttons, there was a lot of people who were very unhappy with it. So I can only imagine when you think about, things that are very, very simple, like camera buttons and volume buttons, especially since one of the few cool things that Samsung does, in my opinion, better than most other phones, is being able to double tap the power button on your phone to launch the camera. Because it launches the camera very, very quickly. Anybody who has a Samsung phone can do that. You just rapid fire press the power button. I don't even open I don't press the camera app icon on my phone. I never do if I'm using a Samsung phone, because I know that I can double tap that power button and launch the camera thing. I don't know how many people know that. That could just be a super nerdy thing that only me and six other people know about, but
it's one of the things that I would be upset about if they did decide to remove that thing.
You're not a nerd.
No.
What do you think, about this change then? Do you think this is a smart approach that they're taking, this sort of gradual change, but an option to go a little deeper if you want?
Yeah, I think that this split is significant because it used to be that the Galaxy Note was made for people who were considered power users, people who were on their phone constantly, people who lived on their phone. They needed the bigger battery and the bigger screen so that they could either get more work done or so that they had a bigger screen to watch, you know, movies on and things like that. For a while, one of the biggest markets for the Note was actually the Asian markets, because there were people who were using it as their entire TV ecosystem. It was all going through the phone. So having that big screen was a big thing, but screens have gotten larger everywhere. So that's not quite the draw that it used to be. So now there's this weird split in the Note, kind of like the Galaxy S10, where you've got the smaller version and the bigger version. And the bigger version is now where you're seeing these kind of power user features, like the additional camera and the bigger battery and things like that. Whereas the normal Note 10 really kind of feels similar to the larger Galaxy S10. So it's hard to say how successful that plan is going to be, because there's a $100 difference basically between the high end version of the Galaxy S10 and the Galaxy Note 10. So you're looking at right around $1,000for if you want the basic model, and then close to $1,200 if you want the fully fleshed out version of the Note 10 Plus, and that is crossing several lines that we've heard from a lot of people say is just way too much to spend on a phone.
Nintendo Switch is getting new packaging, and I'm curious about why we're talking about something kind of as prosaic as packaging. Why is that a big deal?
It is weird to have to point this thing out, but it's actually kind of important in this case. Nintendo has refreshed the Nintendo Switch model, and it's done it very quietly. If you go and buy a Nintendo Switch in a store right now, it actually has bigger battery than the version that was released 2 years ago. It has a better, sharper display made by a different company that was on it. And the controllers that stick on the side of the Switch are actually less likely to have some of the problems that the early versions had with, where it doesn't stay connected quite as strictly, what is called Joy-Con drift. But Nintendo didn't tell anybody that all of these changes were happening, that you're not going to see an ad saying, if you want this new updated Switch, go to Best Buy now and get it. The only thing that they did was update the packaging. Previously, the Nintendo Switch packaging had a white background with a picture of the Switch and advertising, marketing material on it. And now it has a very bright red background to it and a slightly different picture of the Nintendo Switch. And that's the only change on the outside of the box. If you walk up into a store that has both the old version and the new version of the Nintendo Switch on the shelf, you will see one that has white background and one that has a red background. And in this case, it is the red background that is the version that you want.
Why do you think they're doing that this way?
This is something that Nintendo has done for a lot of different things. There are very few people who know that there have been four different versions of the Nintendo Switch Pro controller. And the only way that you know that is by looking at the packaging, and it has, either revision A, B, C, or D, kind of tucked away neatly on the packaging. This is kind of Nintendo's deal. If they make slight changes, what it considers slight changes, it doesn't make a big deal out of it. It just says, it just pushes it as a slight revision and then sells it. And that actually makes people who know better, who want the newer version, it actually kind of makes things a little difficult for them, because you have to go and kind of dig around to make sure that the thing that you're buying is the right thing. You can walk into a store right now and see very clearly that the red packaging is on a shelf. But if you want to buy from Amazon right now, none of the Amazon listings have the updated packaging in the picture. So you kind of have to buy and then hope that the one that shows up is the one with the red packaging.
That just seems crazy.
Oh, it's a little bit on the crazy side, but this is something that Nintendo has done for many years now, and for some reason it keeps working for them. So
we have talked before about getting things repaired, particularly when it comes to Apple, and it's making it harder to replace the battery at third-party vendors. This isn't new, is it, or is it?
Apple has had a long kind of frustrating history with what is called the right to repair. There have been legal challenges to this. There is a long-standing conversation. Apple believes that it is doing the right thing by making it so that not every single person offering to collect $20 from you to replace your screen can just up and replace your screen, because it means that they could possibly use lower quality materials, or they could do things that would access your personal information to steal all of your photos and possibly upload the less than safe for work ones to the internet. There's a lot of reasons Apple gives for wanting to provide this as a security and safety feature. But at the end of the day, it has had a long history of putting rules in place that make choosing where you want to get your phone or laptop repaired very difficult and often very costly. The most recent version of this is the battery. Apple has made a big deal out of being able to go into the store and get the battery on your phone replaced for reasonably inexpensive. And make sure that phone is able to last for significantly longer. Because frequently the thing that dies on the phone first is the battery.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing so at a store that is not an Apple store, when you put these third-party batteries in the phone, often because they are less expensive or because there's just not an Apple store in your area, and this place is the only place in town that will do the thing,
mm-hmm.
Apple software will detect that it is not an official Apple battery and will actually remove or lock you out of features on the phone that will let you see what the health of that battery is. So there's a battery health thing in an iPhone now that you can check, and it says, hey, when you recharge this phone, it's actually only recharging to about 80% of what its capacity is.
Mm-hmm.
So you're eventually going to want to replace this battery. That feature is not available to you anymore if you get a third-party battery installed. And then that's just a policy that Apple has put in place.
How are people responding?
It's a fairly negative reaction. Apple is pretty insistent that this is a safety feature, that this, is ensuring that the batteries that are in place are the highest quality, that ensuring that the information that the software is providing is as accurate as it can be, and also making sure that you're not going to someone who may use tools to access your personal information without Apple's permission or without your permission. And that, I think, is a difficult sell. I think being able to explain that to someone and have it, make sense is difficult when, this is a thing that you paid for. You should have the ability to make changes to it the way that you see fit, because it's a purchase that you made. And that really is kind of the baseline of the entire right to repair conversation is I bought this thing from you. It belongs to me now. I should be able to do what I want for it, even and often cases, especially if the warranty has already expired.
Yeah, especially if the warranty has expired. That was the next thing out of my mouth. I mean, if there's a warranty, you got to bring your car back to the dealer. You got to do this. You got to do that. But this is even if the warranty has expired.
It's a software-based thing. It doesn't really matter. Like right. The phone is not checking your warranty condition. It's just automatically turning it off.
How are third-party vendors responding to this?
There have been two responses. The one is to kind of shrug and say, look, we're, 30 or 40 bucks cheaper, and you don't really need that feature on a daily basis to begin with. So, come to us. We're kind of the only game in town, which is not the best response, but in some cases, it really is the only shop in town that can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other has been a little more devious. There have actually been several repair shops that have figured out how to kind of add in a version of the chip that Apple uses to kind of trick the phone into thinking that it is an official battery when it is, in fact, not. And I'm sure that that's something that Apple will try and find a workaround in the next software update. But for the moment, it is a thing that works. And not every shop has this, but it is a feature that you can request in many places.
The saga continues. Russell Holly, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.